session number 27344, wheel 24.
From McCandless, wheel 24.
Well, this hotel had an awful lot of snipers and some bigger guns. I don't know what they were, but they were really being a pest, and they were stopping a particular advance that they wanted to make. And there was one place, I think they were probably firing shoulder-held grenades or something like that from this window in the hotel, and the army wasn't able to get heavy enough fire on it to stop him. So they called us up and said, we'll fire around with red smoke, and then we'll give you directions from the red smoke as to the target we want you to attack. So they would fire, and they said, around's fired, red smoke. Yeah, see the red smoke? Well, there's a hotel 200 yards to the left of that, or wherever it was. Yes. Third story, yes. Window on the left-hand side, left-hand end, yes. There's a gun there we want to get rid of. And we could deliver a rocket into that window. And it just blow that end off the hotel. And it was as accurate as that. And the army was able to speak to us and get us to attack a target as accurately as that. So they were delighted with us. They really were. We had tremendous fun with them when we did see them.
That sounds remarkable in the sense that you were able to identify the target that easily from the air.
Oh, yes. Well, let's face it, the weather there was glorious. Could see for miles. But it was exactly the same in Korea, you know. They used to fire a coloured round, and when you identified you could see the coloured round, they would give you directions from that, left or right or up or down or whatever it was, until you got to the target they wanted. And they would be able to distinguish it by something which you could see from the air. But yes, you could get as accurate as that.
And the liaison officer would know that, would he? To sort of, oh, yeah. He would know how to direct you from the air, in a sense, would he?
We used to practice this.
Would he have had sort of a familiarisation flight with you so he would know what to look for from the air as opposed to what he'd be seeing from the ground?
Yes, he did. But not only that, he was just a chum in the bar as well. And just talking amongst ourselves, he would pick up bits of information which he could use. And we always got on extremely well with the army officers that came to join us. And I think they enjoyed that as a detachment from their regiment. But of course, it was a job where they had to go ashore and be liaison with any other regiment as well. But they enjoyed it, and we enjoyed it. And he was always very, very helpful in getting us to the right place at the right time. If he couldn't for some reason, it didn't very often happen. But it would perhaps be a radio failure or something like that, either from his part or from our part. But generally speaking, the cooperation was very good.
You're obviously talking about ground support roles once the forces had landed. Did you have any targets that you had to make an initial strike before the forces had landed?
Oh, yes, but this was sort of the first and second day, as it were, yes. But our first day, or day and a half, was spent making sure that there wasn't going to be any air opposition. And then we concentrated on army depots and army movements and try and stop them moving equipment or ammunition or whatever it was towards our forces. So it was a matter of interdiction, as they call it, flying around at a height where you were out of small arms fire but low enough to see what was going on. The same as we did in Korea. Exactly the same sort of job, and making sure they weren't able to move the stuff.
What height would that be usually?
5,000-ish.
So you're fairly safe from small arms fire that height?
Yes, yeah. And it's a height where in reasonable weather you've got very wide view. This is another thing that we used to practice up in the north of Scotland. We used to, one of us would go round and pick targets somewhere in the area. It might be a bridge with four arches, or it might be a church with a square tower instead of a spire. And we used to give the pilots either a course and distance to steer and say, what's at the end of that? And then give them another course and distance to steer and say, what's at the end of that? So they had to be accurate in their flying, and they had to be able to find what it was at the far end. And this is the sort of thing we used to do, just to get them used to flying and looking on the ground to pick out a specific object. Or you could say to them, there is a tunnel entrance in the area of a square mile. Go and pinpoint it accurately. So they'd have to go and look for a tunnel entrance, and then say, that is at position. And then they would give a six-figure map reference. And the six-figure map reference was similar to as done nowadays. It was on a particular map, and you would have what they call eastings and northings. There's a grid printed across the map. And on down the side of the map, there's a number of numbers. And every grid is a number, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And in between is assumed to be divided into 10 parts. And then you'd the same along the bottom. So when you got the position of this particular object, you would look at the grid and you'd say, this is 5.6 or 560 east and 782 north. So you just look on the grid and there's the tunnel entrance. So it was practice. And that's the sort of thing that we used to do, to fly around and practice. And then other things we would do was the army officer would go ashore without telling us where he was going. And then when we would fly over the area, and he would call us up and direct us to targets without us knowing where he was and what he was going to direct us onto. So again, it was just getting used to the voices and the way they said things, and he'd get used to the way we said things. And it really worked out extremely well. And army cooperation was one of my favourite exercises. And well, in fact, doing it in earnest was very satisfying, to be able to support the army as accurately as we could.
It seems like almost the accumulation of all that training you'd done.
Oh yes, it is, absolutely. And that's what it was all about. And I really pitied this squadron that was formed up out of spare hands, as it were. When on the first day we were being briefed to go, and one of the jobs was, we knew for certain that in the Bitter Lakes at the south end of the Suez Canal there was a large merchant ship loaded with cement, which they were intending to take into the canal and sink. And then that would have been a very difficult job to get rid of it afterwards. So as far as we were concerned, it was fairly important on the first exercise to sink that ship out in the Bitter Lakes rather than allow it to get into the canal. And I was totally astonished to see that the squadron chosen to go and sink this ship was the squadron of spare hands, and we knew that their dive bombing wasn't accurate, and they all missed, and the ship steamed into the canal and sank itself. Now, if that's not stupidity, I don't know what is. But I couldn't understand why the senior aviation officer in the group allowed it to happen, why he chose it that way. It seems to me so obvious, but then what's obvious from lower down the line isn't always obvious from above. Obviously, he's looking for a different perspective. But it did seem stupid to me. That's the sort of thing that used to go on, which was bloody annoying.
In that initial strike phase of the first day and a half or so,
yeah,
would you be given secondary targets?
Oh, yes, always. Every time we flew with secondary targets, if you remember, the time we were supposed to be doing a rocket attack, the time we set off, we were nearly out of fuel. And we had to take the secondary target, which was, in fact, on the coast. And it was the breakwater at Alexandra Harbour, and to get rid of the gun positions on that breakwater. Now, the breakwater wasn't affecting us from the air or anything we were doing, but I suppose ultimately they wanted to take ships in, and they just didn't want to have opposition from people on the breakwater. So that was the secondary target, and we managed to scatter those satisfactorily because there were so many rockets and so few targets, we really couldn't miss.
With something like that, where Alexander had anti-aircraft fire around it on the breakwater, would you generally have avoided that area when you were flying anyway, unless you were...
No, we were going over at a reasonable height usually. We wouldn't have flown into it low level unless we had to, and we didn't have to, so we didn't. But 5,000 feet is really a very comfortable height to fly, to see what's going on the ground and be away from any immediate danger.
We often hear now about friendly fire incidents. Was there any occasions of that during the Suez operation that you're aware of?
Well, as far as we're concerned, there was never anything on us, the flyers, and I can't remember hearing about any of us accidentally dropping weapons on the army. The trouble is, you see, that when you were doing army cooperation, quite often you were firing at targets which were within easy rifle fire range of our front line. So you had to be very careful that you were, in fact, firing at the enemy and not our own lines. But I can't remember any occasion in Suez where we attacked our own forces. Can't remember any.
You were also operating with the French Air Force, weren't you, at the time, in the operation? Did you have any contact with them at all?
No, none at all. None at all. I don't know where they were flying from, but they didn't have their carrier there. What was their carrier?
Aramage.
Yeah. That had been the Colossus, incidentally, originally. No, the Aramage wasn't there. So if there were French aircraft around, we didn't see them and we didn't hear them. And we weren't warned that they were there. So where they were, I don't know. The RAF used to fly over fairly high level, take their photographs and fly back, and we'd know when they were on the go. But no, I don't remember French at all. I think it was mainly French troops on the ground, wasn't it?
I was wondering, you know, when you actually made the strikes, would you get a fairly instant feedback from what you'd achieved by the liaison officer?
Well, again, you see, we were in a absolutely very lucky position where you could afford to turn around and fly back over it and see what had happened. Now, that doesn't very often happen. But with no air opposition and very little ground opposition, we could swan around to our heart's content and see what we'd done. And, for example, if you'd gone along a line of army trucks and strafed them right along the line, you could come around afterwards and count how many were burning, that sort of thing. So there was no difficulty in having feedback.
That sounds quite exhilarating, to be able to attack a convoy when you've actually given people who've been on the convoy the chance to get away.
Yes, that's right. Well, it was satisfying in so much as you knew you'd stop them moving stuff, but you didn't necessarily have to write off half the Egyptian army to do it.
Would that have been a relatively easy thing to do should you have just been attacking them, though?
Oh, if we'd taken them by surprise and hit them, well, there's no doubt that many would have been killed. Because we were really quite accurate. And with the 30mm cannon, they were quite devastating on road vehicles.
It's obviously something I wasn't aware of, in the sense of that there were orders there not to cause casualties if possible.
Oh yes, absolutely. A few casualties, and no civilian casualties if you could avoid it. And I think, generally speaking, we did manage to avoid it. But when we did attack these gun positions on the breakwater at Alexandria, obviously the gunners were in the gun pits firing at us. But then that's what you do in war. You fire at somebody and they fire back, and probably one of you gets killed. But generally we tried to keep casualties down to a minimum.
During the operation as well, were the aircraft marked up with stripes at all?
Yeah, same as Korea. The black and white stripes around the fuselage after end and around both main planes. And I don't know whether it became standard when there was cooperation required or whether we just had those markings on anyway. I really don't know. It's the sort of thing we just accept, and that's how the aircraft are marked, without knowing who said that was the way they were to be marked or why. I'm afraid in the service you do tend to accept things that are given to you just at face value. No, I couldn't tell you very much about that, but certainly the aircraft were marked with red and white. A photograph of my aircraft in the other room.
How long were you operating all the series?
6 days. And it really was such a waste of time, because the Americans stopped it. And of course, Anthony Eden was a broken man after that, simply because he'd made such a cock of it all. I find it difficult to understand why the British government, French government and Israeli government thought they were going to be able to achieve anything, because there was a lot of cooperation between them beforehand, although they all denied it. And it seemed to me that whatever we did on the ground was not going to affect the end result in the Suez Canal itself.
Certainly wouldn't have been a long-term solution to it.
No, certainly not. Certainly not. Because any of the ships from Arab countries going through the canal could have chosen at any time to sink themselves and cock the whole thing up. See, at that time, there was only the one canal. There weren't two canals as there are now. So it would really have blocked the whole thing very quickly. And in fact, it was blocked for how long? Can't remember, 2 years, something like that. So, what a waste of time it was.
You said that you'd made yourself slightly unpopular with your view of that. What was the attitude of your fellow pilots once the operation was really called off? Did they change their ideas about what they'd been doing? Or,
well, I think we didn't discuss it much, to be honest. We just accepted the fact that it was over and we were going back home. It wasn't discussed very much, but I think they did realise that although we'd been sent to do that, it was a total waste of time. But it happens so often in the services. You're sent to do a job and at the end of it you realise what a waste of time that was.
It must have been a strange feeling, though, because obviously you must have been very satisfied in the results of your operational stuff in comparison with the usefulness of the whole operation.
Oh, that's right. No, we did our part very well. But the end result was a fiasco. But I suppose if we'd thought about it too deeply, we might have got a bit sad, but that's not the nature of the men involved, not generally speaking, anyway. There were one or two, I suppose, felt that way inclined, but not very many.
And what about the performance of the Seahawk? You said it was obviously not a warplane, but how had it performed during that 6 days?
Great. It really, from a point of view of serviceability and availability to us, the maintenance ratings were absolutely excellent, and if we asked for a maximum effort, we got it. And maximum effort in a situation like that is quite difficult to achieve, because aircraft, and the more complicated the aircraft, can go unserviceable very quickly over tiny things. And of course, even if it was only a radio failure, then you didn't go, because you could have been a menace if you're going off to do Army cooperation. But maintenance ratings did an absolutely excellent job. I remember on one occasion, each of the carriers had come out with its own little escort of destroyers. And after some discussion amongst the air crew and the seamen, they decided that the way to operate the carriers was to make what they called a ring fence. And this was the destroyers going round in a circle about, shall we say, an eighth of the diameter apart. And the distance between the destroyers was the distance of their effective sonar. And their sonar swept from dead ahead outwards only, because after the first sweep of the day, they knew there was nothing in the circle. So they were able to go around at their best sonar speed and just keep pinging all the way around. And we knew that inside this circle, there were no submarines. And the size of the circle was calculated because we knew that a ship flying off, shall we say, 16 aircraft and landing on 16 aircraft would take X minutes. And in X minutes, at 30 knots, it would go so far. So the diameter of the circle was so far. So the ship, the carriers, used to do what they wanted within the circle, and then when they were getting ready to fly off, they would go right to the diameter, turn round, and then belt across the circle at high speed, fly off, fly on, and then go back into manoeuvring around. And with the three carriers, this worked beautifully. But of course, the three carriers were fairly close together within the circle. Albion and Bulwark, almost identical, except for a different identity letter painted on the side of the island, an eagle, which was quite different, and everyone could see it was different. And we were coming back one day, and my number three called up to say he'd got a hydraulic failure. So I said, OK, you wait till the last, and wait at high level until we've landed on, and then come down and land on last, because if there's any hiccup, you can go into the barrier. So he said, OK, and we all went in and landed on. And it so happened that Albion and Bulwark were operating together at that time. And it was Tommy Lees, actually. I called Tommy up as we were just going in to land on and said, OK, come and land. So he came down to land on and landed on in Albion instead of Bulwark, poor chap. And they had an unserviceable aircraft to get ready and send back to us. So when it came back to us, it came back with the other squadron's insignia painted all over it. Tommy didn't live that down for quite a while. But it was so easy because the ships were absolutely identical except for the letter. And if he was somewhat perturbed about his hydraulic failure, perhaps he wasn't looking carefully enough at the letters. That's the sort of thing that could happen and did happen.
When you were leading the four aircraft on an operation, what level of direction would you give them? Would it be single words, or would you keep and maintain radio silence, or quite a tight?
Yeah, maintain radio silence. Do it all by signals. Don't trip, man. Yeah, in all operations, the fleet air arm has always operated with radio silence, because if the ship's talking to the aircraft, they give away the position very quickly, and that's not one of the things that the captain of the ship likes to do. So we are used to doing it all by radio silence, and even in Korea, we used to do it by signals, except for the actually attacking, and you would say, stand by to attack, attack. And that was the formation signals, where if you were flying in close formation, you could do it with hand signals. And we had a set series of signals which everyone knew what they would have to do in order to do what the leader was signalling. And if you're flying in battle formation was two pairs about half a mile apart, and they couldn't see a hand signal at that range. So we had a series of signals that we could use by just moving the wings. And when you're in battle formation, you're really generally speaking, going in one direction to somewhere, in which case you don't have to change very much, or you're patrolling up and down behind the front line of the army or something like that. And you go, this battle formation is designed to allow the pair on the left to cover the pair on the right, and the pair on the right to cover the pair on the left, so that you can see people coming in from astern from quite long range. And then if you did have an attack, then you would just use the radio very quickly to say, stand by to break starboard, go. And everyone would go around in as tight a turn as they could in the indicated direction. And then if you broke up into a melee after that, you would perhaps not form up again at all, depending on how big the breakup was or how much of a melee it was. But if it was just a matter of a quick pass, as we had in Korea, where the jets came down through us like a dose of salts and went off again, we would just break starboard or turn round and go in the opposite direction. And then we'd be doing the same thing, flying half a mile apart in pairs, looking out for each other. And it was always a matter of just giving a wing signal. The leader would dip his wing twice to the right, and everyone would go round to the right or to the left, or, you know, just using signals like that to manoeuvre very simple manoeuvres. If you wanted something more complicated, then we would have to do it by radio. But again, that wasn't compromising the ship. The ship wasn't involved in this conversation. But as I said before, when we were in Korea, the Americans were on the same radio frequencies, and we couldn't get a word in edgeways. They were absolutely having conversations on the radio, and it was ridiculous, really. Stuff that didn't matter two hoots to the operation that they were chatting about. And sometimes it was difficult to get in standby to attack because of what was going on elsewhere. But generally speaking, we did it by signals and radio silence. Towards the end of our time in Suez, I think it must have been the last day or the second last day, General Burns of the United Nations was flying from Cairo to Israel, and we were required to give him an escort, and he was flying in a United Nations Dakota, and they were flying, I suppose, probably about as high as the Dakota could go. I suppose the Dakota was about 20,000 feet. So we were flying above the Dakota, 35 to 40,000 feet, which is about as high as the Seahawk can go anyway. And we were sort of just going like this, weaving right and left across the Dakota and making sure that no one else was coming near it. And about halfway through the trip from Cairo to Israel, my cockpit pressure failed entirely. So that meant it got very cold very quickly. But also, because the pressure had gone, it meant that the internal pressure in the cockpit was the same as the pressure outside, which at 40,000 feet is very low. Now, my oxygen was still working, so we were quite content to stay there. And we knew we'd come down fairly slowly, so there wouldn't be any risk of bends or any other activities like that. But the thing I noticed was that when we were flying around very gently, every injury that I had ever had started to ache. I mean, where I had dislocated my shoulder, that was aching like hell. Where I'd broken a bone in my hand, very painful. Where I'd sprained my ankle, very painful. And I was just amazed to notice that it was all the places where I'd had injuries in the past, you know, sometimes many years before, yet these pains came up because of the change in pressure.